In late January 1861, a little more than a month after the Pease River fight, Isaac Parker took his charges to Austin to try to convince the Texas legislature to give them a pension, a sort of compensation for the hardships they had endured. This was a clever idea, but would require a good deal of political grease, and he was exactly the sort of man who could pull it off. As a lifelong politician and elected official, Isaac knew everyone in the Capitol. He and Sam Houston, then governor of Texas, were old friends. They had fought together in the War of 1812. Later, Houston had sent Isaac as an emissary to Washington to gather support for the Texas Revolution. The Parkers arrived in Austin on a chilly January day to find the city firmly in the grip of secession fever. Abraham Lincoln had been elected president the previous fall, and anti-union sentiment in Texas was in full cry. Austin was its center. Throughout the month of January, secessionists marched up and down the rutted dirt of Congress Avenue, the city's broad main street that was newly lined with sturdy limestone buildings. It climbed gently from the Colorado River toward the imposing new three-story domed state capitol, which was fronted by marble Ionic columns and a huge portico. The secessionists were in their glory. They were an unruly bunch, carrying torches and signs that condemned Lincoln and his abolitionist government. They held parades and marches on a moment's notice. One featured a loud brass band, a long line of carriages containing ladies who fluttered Texas flags, and a boisterous contingent of men on horseback, all led by Ranger Rip Ford, who pranced down the avenue on a white stallion. Texas flags flew everywhere, and there was even talk of a Second Republic. The air was cold and bracing, and Texans were in a high mood. The secession convention, which began on January 28th, featured an Olympian fight between Governor Houston, who opposed breaking away from the United States, and almost everyone else, who favored it. The old statesman delivered one of the greatest speeches of his career, pleading that it is not unmanly to pause and at least endeavor to avert the calamity. People listened respectfully to him, and then voted 171-6 in favor of secession. That took place on February 1, 1861. On April 12, Confederate batteries opened fire on Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, signaling the start of the Civil War. Into one of these volatile debates came Cynthia Ann Parker, cleaned up and dressed nicely by two prominent Austin women who had taken a special interest in her. They were showing her the splendors of the white man's world. She entered through the massive portico and climbed the stone steps to the gallery on the second floor, where she sat and listened to men debate an issue she could not possibly have comprehended in a language she did not remember. Still, she became visibly agitated. She took up her daughter and ran for the door. After she was tackled and brought back, she was always being tackled and brought back in those days, it occurred to her companions that she believed the men on the floor of the legislature were sitting in judgment of her. She thought they were deciding whether or not to put her to death. Here, too, Cynthia Ann and her daughter were objects of great curiosity. She was visited by very many, reported one newspaper, which meant that crowds of people came and stared at her. She was visibly distraught. She spoke sparely and only through an interpreter. At one point, she stated that she was surprised to discover that the Comanches were not, as she had supposed, the most numerous and powerful people in the world. Or at least that is what one newspaper reporter heard. While in Austin, she sat for a tintype, an early type of photograph. The resulting image shows a woman who has clearly been gussied up, though she looks deeply uncomfortable in her new clothes. Her hair is pulled back in what looks like some sort of net. She wears a patterned cotton blouse and a striped dress and what looks to be a woolen robe clasped at the neck. Her unusually large and work-scarred hands are crossed on her lap. Her gaze is direct, supplicating, and utterly miserable. Her misery notwithstanding, Isaac's plan worked. 2 months after their visit, the Texas legislature voted to grant Cynthia Ann a $100 a year pension for 5 years, plus a league of land, 4,428 acres. Here, too, she was treated as a special case. The money and land was not to come to her, but to be held in trust for her by her cousins Isaac Duke Parker and Benjamin Parker, as though they were the guardians of a minor or of a mentally infirm adult who was unable to speak for herself. Back in Byrdville, Cynthia Ann continued to be disconsolate, living at her Uncle Isaac's house. She wept. She tried to escape. She refused to cooperate. Nothing changed. And so, in the hope that she might find greater happiness elsewhere, and perhaps also to get her out of Isaac's hair, she began a long and strange odyssey through the homes of various relatives that had the ultimate effect of taking her deeper and deeper into East Texas, farther and farther from the Great Plains, and thus from any hope that she could ever be reunited with her people. The first stop on this journey was the oddest of all. Hearing of her unhappiness with Isaac, Cynthia Ann's cousin William Parker and his wife, who lived 2 miles south of Isaac, had volunteered to take her in. His generosity seemed innocent enough, but William, as it turned out, was not acting out of charity. He had a very specific and entirely self-serving reason for inviting Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower to his home. Shortly after Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower moved, Cousin William sent a letter to a Texan named Coho Smith. Coho's real name was John Jeremiah Smith. His nickname came as the result of being wounded by a lance. Coho in Spanish means lame. He was one of those marginal, colorful characters who inhabited the Texas frontier in its early days. He recorded his adventures in a book of his own drawings and observations he dubbed his Cohographs. He was self-educated and fluent in a number of languages, including Comanche. As a boy, he had spent a year as a Comanche captive. At the time he received Parker's letter, sometime in late 1861, he was working as a Confederate cotton agent, though he had also worked as a teacher and cabinet maker. In the letter, Parker explained that Cynthia Ann had come to live with him and begged Smith to come to his house, a distance of 189 miles, to act as translator. He said that he and his wife were anxious to have a conversation with their new guest, who could not speak English. For whatever reason, Smith agreed and soon arrived at the Parker place. When he asked where Cynthia Ann was, Parker replied, "I saw her go out the gate about half an hour ago. Let us go and hunt her up. She is generally moping around here in these woods." They found her 100 yards from the house, sitting on a log, with her elbows on her knees and her hands to her face. She wore an old sunbonnet. Prairie Flower was playing on the ground. She had constructed a small corral of sticks and was talking to herself in Comanche. William indicated to his cousin that dinner was ready by shoving his hand down his throat. Cynthia Ann shot a sharp, disapproving glance at Smith, then began to follow them back to the house. His wife explained to Smith that so many people came to see her that it annoyed her. "That is why she looked at you so spitefully." She was still a figure of curiosity, still being gawked at. Back at the house, Smith spoke to her in Comanche. "E wanikim," he said, which meant, "come here." According to Smith, her reaction was immediate and almost violent. She sprang with a scream and knocked about half the dishes off the table, scaring Mr. Parker. She ran around to me and fell on the floor and caught me around both ankles, crying in Comanche, "Ima mimiro," meaning, "I am going with you." Now she came fully alive. Sitting on a chair next to Smith, she held him by one arm, talking all the time to me in Comanche and Spanish, mixing the two languages all the time. Her Spanish was surprisingly good. She would not eat, but kept talking instead. "Oh, don't eat," she said in Comanche. "Let us talk. Oh, my friend, do let us talk." Then she switched to Spanish and said something that did not make any sense. "I want to go back to my 2 boys, and Billy there has told me by signs that he wants to go to my people also. I said, Billy, do you want to go to the Comanches? He said, Yes, I do. And that is why I sent for you to interpret, for it is this way. Perplexed, Smith then asked William Parker what she meant. Parker, at length, explained. He told Smith that he had served in the Confederate Army. A Union bullet had shattered his thigh bone and had partly crippled him. He was not crippled enough, however, to avoid being sent back to the war by the conscription officers he called dad-blasted heel flies. The prospect terrified him, as did the notion of being hanged or shot as a deserter. Like thousands of other young men in the Confederate States, Parker had rushed to the recruiting posts in 1861 in anticipation of a brief and glorious war. Now he wanted out. He was desperate. And he had a plan. I want you to take me and Cynthia Ann to the Comanches, he told Smith. I can stay with them until this cruel war is over. The idea was absurd, as though he conceived of the Comanche tribe as a sort of rooming house where he could stay for a few years. Somehow, Cynthia Ann had been able to grasp this idea clearly and to comprehend that Smith had been summoned for this reason. The two Parker relatives had obviously found a way to communicate. Smith, who had no interest in such a venture, for which he, too, could be hanged, offered the weak excuse that there were no horses available. Horses? Cynthia Ann exclaimed. That is nothing. There is some first-rate horses running here. Don't hesitate a moment about the horses. Oh, I tell you, mi corazón está llorando todo el tiempo por mis dos hijos. My heart is crying all the time for my two sons. Then, switching back to Comanche, she said, En sacasok bukunisua? Do you want a heap of horses? Then again in Spanish, No mas lleva mi. Only take me. She offered Smith all the girls or wives he wanted. She offered 10 guns, 10 horses, 10 wives. Cynthia Ann's harangue, Smith wrote, continued into the early morning hours. When Smith asked why she and Billy could not go by themselves, she answered that she thought he would be killed and she would be made a slave. She had an idea that Coho was tougher than William Parker, the cripple and coward. She was probably right. And of course Smith spoke the Comanche language. The next day, Parker took Smith out to see his illegal still, which he had built following the directions in a book entitled 1,000 Things Worth Knowing, then made one last effort to convince him to help, offering Smith the deed to more than half his 80 acres. They will never get me in the army again, he said. I will suicide first. Smith again refused. He later heard that Parker had managed to find his way to Illinois anyway, and had thus escaped the war. The last thing Smith remembered Cynthia Ann saying was, Si le doy, o mi gente si le doy, todos las muchachas que si quiere, pero bonito y buen mozas. I will give you, or my people will give you, all the girls you want, but pretty and well made. He refused that, too. It must have broken her heart. Coho Smith captured Cynthia Ann as no one else has. Other people saw her as sullen, brooding, unresponsive, detached, despondent, even crazy, or at least so far sunk in savagery as to be irredeemable. In Smith's account, she was smart, aggressive, focused, strong-willed, and intensely practical. She was completely aware of what she wanted, and, at least for that brief moment, of how to get it. Her tragedy was that such a woman was utterly helpless to change the destiny that her family had, with the best of intentions, arranged for her. In early 1862, Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower moved yet again, this time to the home of her younger brother, Silas Jr. He had also been at the fort when it was raided, along with his 3 siblings. For some reason, the Indians had taken Cynthia Ann and John and had spared Silas Jr. and Orlena. Silas and his wife Ann lived with their 3 children in Van Zandt County, deep in the piney woods of East Texas, 27 miles northwest of Tyler. If Cynthia Ann had despaired of getting back home when she was living in Birdville, she was now more than 100 miles east. She was no longer even near the frontier. She must have understood this as they traveled. She was leaving the prairies, heading for the high timber. She must have known she was never getting out. Life was no better with Silas, who was 28 at the time, and stuttered. She did not get along with his wife, who punished Prairie Flower, who was often called Topsanna or Texan, every time she called her mother by her Comanche name. Cynthia Ann kept trying to escape, walking off down the road with her daughter in her arms whenever she was left alone. She said she was going home, just going home. She often slashed her arms and breasts with a knife, drawing blood. This was probably an act of mourning for the death of her husband. Or it could have been a simple expression of misery. On one occasion, she took a butcher knife and cut off her hair. It was around this time that a photograph was taken of Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower that would become famous on the frontier and beyond. They had gone visiting in Fort Worth in the company of Silas, probably dragged along so she would not escape, and had somehow, perhaps at Silas's urging, landed in the photography studio of a man named A.F. Corning. The result was an exceptional and luminous portrait of mother and daughter. In it, Cynthia Ann wears a plain cotton blouse with a kerchief tied loosely at the neck. Her bored, straight, medium brown hair is cropped short. Perhaps this was the result of the butcher knife incident. Her eyes are light and transparent, her gaze disarmingly direct. Again, we see the large, muscular hands and thick wrists. What is most extraordinary about the portrait, however, is Cynthia Ann's exposed right breast, at which the black-haired, swaddled, and obviously quite pretty Prairie Flower is nursing. There is probably no precedent for this sort of photography on the Texas frontier in 1862. White women were not photographed with their breasts exposed. And even if a photographer had taken such a photo, no newspaper would have published it. This one was different. It became the picture of Cynthia Ann that generations of schoolchildren knew. It is still in wide circulation. The only explanation is that because Cynthia Ann was seen and treated as a savage, even though she was as white as any Scots-Irish settler in the South. The double standard is similar to the one National Geographic magazine famously applied in the mid-20th century to photographs of naked African women. The magazine would never have considered showing the breasts of a white woman in its pages. This explains part of the fascination with Cynthia Ann, the sense that, though her skin was white, something darker and more primal lurked beneath. In April 1862, Silas joined the Confederate Army, leaving his pregnant wife to care for their 3 children and also act as jailer for Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower. Ann soon put a stop to it, and Cynthia Ann and Prairie Flower were shipped off yet again, this time to her sister Orlena, who also lived in the vicinity of Tyler, with her husband J.R. O'Quinn. Mother and daughter were moved to a separate house. Now, perhaps because of her growing realization that she was never going back to the Comanches, Cynthia Ann began to adjust. The Civil War had taken most of the able-bodied men, leaving the women to pick up the slack. Cynthia Ann began to relearn English, and in one account, could eventually speak it when she wanted to. She learned how to spin, weave, and sew, and became quite adept at it. Her Comanche experience had taught her how to tan hides, and she became known as the best tanner in the county. According to a neighbor, she was stout and weighed about 140 pounds, well-made, and liked to work. She had a wild expression and would look down when people looked at her. She could use an axe equal to a man and disliked a lazy person. She was an expert in tanning hides with the hair on them, or plaiting or knitting either ropes or whips. She thought her 2 boys were lost on the prairie. This dissatisfied her very much. Part of this adjustment, too, was her reintegration into the Parker family. Many of her relatives lived nearby, and she saw them with some regularity. She had friends, too, in a sense, at least people she could talk to. She even remembered some of the people from the old days. Every Sunday, one of them would take Prairie Flower visiting. The child had learned English quickly and soon spoke it more often than Comanche. She even went to a nearby school. In the account of Cynthia Ann's relative Tom Champion, she had a sunny disposition and was an open-hearted, good woman and always ready to help somebody. Most others had a different view. She was seen weeping on the porch or hiding herself from gawkers who never stopped coming to see the infamous White Squaw. And there was nothing sunny about her refusal to abandon many of her Indian ways, slicing her body with a knife whenever a family member died, and singing her high-pitched, keening songs of Comanche mourning. She had never forgotten. She had only accommodated. She probably stopped believing the Parker family's promises, which they repeated to the end, that she would be allowed to see her sons again. They had always been empty promises. According to T.J. Gates, one of Cynthia Ann's neighbors, she spoke often of the loss of her two sons. I well remember Cynthia Ann Parker and her little Towks. She lived at this time about 6 miles south of the town of Ben Wheeler with her brother-in-law Ruff O'Quinn near Slater's Creek. She thought her two boys were lost on the prairie after she was captured. She would take a knife and hack at her breast until it would bleed, and then put the blood on some tobacco and cry for her lost boys. Champion had the same impression. I don't think she ever knew but that her sons were killed, he wrote. And to hear her tell of the happy days of the Indian dances and see the excitement and pure joy which shone on her face, the memory of it, I am convinced that the white people did more harm by keeping her away from them than the Indians did by taking her at first. Whatever chance she may have had at contentment was destroyed in 1864 when Prairie Flower died of influenza and pneumonia. The little girl's death shattered her. Now there was nothing left of her Comanche life but memories. What her day-to-day life was like in the years after that is largely unknown. The Comanche version is unambiguous. The white men broke her spirit and made her a misfit. She became bitter over her enforced captivity, refused to eat, and eventually starved herself to death. She lived 6 more years until 1870, when she died of influenza, which may have well been complicated by self-starvation. A coffin was built for her by relatives. A bone pin was put in her hair, and they buried her in the Foster Cemetery, 4 miles south of the town of Poynter, which lies between the larger towns of Tyler and Palestine. It is perhaps fitting for someone who had endured so many changes against her will that before she came to her final resting place, she was buried 3 times in 3 different cemeteries. Who was she in the end? A white woman by birth, yes, but also a relic of old Comancheria, of the fading empire of high grass and fat summer moons and buffalo herds that blackened the horizon. She had seen all of that death and glory. She had been a chief's wife. She had lived free on the high, infinite plains as her adopted race had, in the very last place in the North American continent where anyone would ever live or run free. She had died in deep pine woods where there was no horizon, where you could see nothing at all. The woods were just a prison. As far as we know, she died without the slightest comprehension of what happened to her, what larger forces had conspired to take her away from her old life. One thinks of Cynthia Ann on the immensity of the plains, a small figure in buckskin, bending to her chores by a diamond-clear stream. It is late autumn, the end of warring and buffalo hunting. Above her looms a single cottonwood tree, gone bright yellow in the season, its leaves and branches framing a deep blue sky. Maybe she lifts her head to see the children and dogs playing in the prairie grass, and beyond them, the coils of smoke rising into the gathering twilight from 100 lodge fires. And maybe she thinks, just for a moment, that all is right in the world. 13. The Rise of Quanah. The battle was over, and the two boys were alone in the bottoms of the narrow Pease River, among cottonwood and hackberry and walnut and rolling sand hills. They would have shivered in the same bitterly cold north wind that spun tornadoes of blown dust about the white soldiers. The boys were young, 12 and 10 years old, but not too young to understand the horror that had just befallen them. When the soldiers had first come into sight, a great cry of alarm had gone up, and both of them, Quanah and Peanuts, had fled the village. Their mother, Nauta, had been with them. Then, somehow, they had lost her. There was shooting and screaming as the soldiers slashed and blasted their way through the village, killing everyone in sight, even the women with their heavily laden pack mules, even the dogs. Then there was silence. Then the boys were alone. Though they may or may not have witnessed the death of their father, Peeta Nakona, they almost certainly understood that their mother had not been killed. But they obviously got the general idea that everybody else was dead. So they fled. A 12-year-old Comanche boy was not entirely helpless in the wild. He would have been far more competent than a frontier white boy. He would have been, as all Comanche boys were, a superb rider. He would have known how to hunt small game. He would have known something about gathering edible roots and berries. But by the timetables of Comanche culture, Quanah would not, at that point in his life, have been allowed to participate in battle and would probably not even have been allowed on a buffalo or deer hunt. He would never have been permitted to stray very far from camp. He would absolutely never have been left alone in the immensity of the southern plains without food or weapons and with no sense of where his people were. What happened next has been unnoticed or uncredited by the main chroniclers of Comanche history, largely because Quanah himself later forcefully denied that he was even at the Battle of Pease River or that his father had been killed there. Both assertions were untrue and had to do with Quanah's interest in cleansing what would have been a terrible stain on Peeta Nakona's record. The Comanches saw Pease River as a fiasco and a disgrace, and it had happened entirely on his watch. Quanah and Peanuts were at the camp because their mother said they were. She was frantic because of it. We also know that two, and only two, riders survived the fight and managed to get away. We know this because Charles Goodnight and 10 scouts under his command tracked them from the confluence of the Pease River and Mule Creek to a large canyon near the foot of the Llano Estacado, somewhere between 75 and 100 miles to the west. He never saw their faces, only the tracks of their horses. Goodnight and his men found a large Indian camp, the ultimate destination of all that buffalo meat and other provision the soldiers had found on Mule Creek. The scouts were able to get quite close to it. As Goodnight described it, "The Indians had not seen us approaching, and it is a mystery to me yet why they had not kept a better lookout, as the spies, the Indian boys, had reached the camp to report the battle. There were approximately 1,000 Indians in this camp. We scoured back up the canyon to where I found a sharp curve. Here we could be seen only in front of this curve. I threw the men into it to wait until dark, fearing we would be discovered and knowing we would have no show to live if we were." According to Goodnight, Quanah later gave him this version of what happened in the camp. "When the two Indian guides, who had escaped from the party killed by Ross, had reached the main body of Indians, they reported that there were 10,000 of us. As soon as the main body of Indians could get ready, they moved back north, where Quanah stated they wintered from Washita to the Wichita Mountains. They suffered much from provisions, for they were entirely north of the buffalo." Quanah knew all of this unusual detail because he was the one who arrived at the camp to tell them the terrible news, and to inform them, with the naive exaggeration of a 12-year-old, that there were 10,000 soldiers. Only a child could have failed to distinguish a tiny irregular force of rangers and bluecoats from a full army division. But consider what the boy had accomplished. Abandoned in the December wilderness without food, and pursued by a band of men aroused by the blood sport of the Pease River killings and fully motivated to catch him, he had managed, with his little brother in tow, to follow the tracks of his fellow band members, who had left 2 or 3 days before, across a wide swath of the broken, undulating West Texas prairie. He had presumably done at least part of this at night, to stay ahead of Goodnight, who was in those days one of the few white men with the ability to track riders through wilderness. Had the boy made any errors, or not succeeded in finding the village, Goodnight would certainly have caught him. Goodnight reported that the two riders had caused a large commotion when they arrived in the Comanche village. Of course they had. Not only because they carried the terrible news of the battle, and thus of the loss of the band's food for the winter, but also because Quanah and his little brother had done something absolutely extraordinary, nearly unbelievable, even by Comanche standards. When Quanah was born in 1848, in a teepee near the Wichita Mountains, in what is now southwestern Oklahoma, white men were still a world away. The Penaticas were being progressively destroyed along the line of settlement in central Texas, but no white men would yet dare to cross the Red River in pursuit of Comanches. The horrible, disease-bearing scourge of the 49ers had not yet swept through on the Santa Fe and other trails. The buffalo still roamed the plains in their millions. And in this world, still insulated from the ravages that would come, the Comanches did what they had always done. They procreated, hunted, and most important, made war on other Indian tribes. A few weeks after Cynthia Ann gave birth to Quanah, warriors in her band, the Nokonis, or Wanderers, left to fight a Navajo war party. Comanche-Navajo enmity went back a long way, back to the days when the people had swept down from the Wind River country to challenge the Apaches in New Mexico. These same Navajos, discovering that the village was now vulnerable, attacked. This was an old Indian tactic. But instead of massacring the village and its inhabitants, as they had expected to do, the 16 attackers ran into fierce resistance from the men who had remained behind. The Navajos fled, taking 200 Comanche horses with them. They were soon tracked down. 3 of them were killed, and the horses were recovered. When the victorious Comanches returned, there were 4 days of joyous singing and dancing, while the scalps of the 3 dead Navajos were paraded about on a pole. This was Indian life on the plains. It went on all the time, more or less invisible to white men. Had things gone a bit differently, the baby Quanah might have been skewered on a Navajo lance. That, of course, would have spawned a revenge raid, which would have invited a counter-raid, and the stakes of blood vengeance would have gone up all across the plains. Instead, one of the first things Quanah saw was a victory dance. Quanah's childhood is divided by his father's death and his mother's capture into 2 strikingly different periods. For his first 12 years, he was the son of a powerful war chief, a man with much influence and many horses, a talented hunter. We do not know many of its details, but in Comanche terms, he led a privileged life. The family was apparently happy, and Quanah later claimed many fond memories of his mother and father. So fearful was Pita Nakona that his white wife would be taken from him that when Comancheros or other traders passed through his camp, he often blackened her face with ashes and made her hide away. This partly explains the dearth of Cynthia Ann sightings over the years. Quanah grew up the way most Comanche boys did. By the time he was 4, he would have been riding an old pack horse. By 5, he managed a pony of his own. By 6, he was riding young colts bareback, and soon after that, he was enlisted to help herd ponies. Like all Comanche boys, he would have become expert at roping and catching horses. From this point onward, he spent an enormous amount of time in the saddle. His horse quickly became, as it was for all of the people, men and women, an extension of his physical being. As he learned to ride, the Comanche boy was initiated into the secrets of weaponry, usually by his grandfather or another elderly male. At 6, he was given a bow and blunt arrows and taught to shoot. He soon began hunting with real arrows, going out with other boys and shooting birds. In the Comanche culture, boys were allowed extraordinary freedom. They did no menial labor of any kind. They did not fetch water or wood. They did not have to help pack or unpack during the band's frequent moves. Instead, they roved about in gangs, wrestling, swimming, racing their horses. They would often follow birds and insects, shooting hummingbirds with special headless arrows that had split foreshafts. They shot grasshoppers and ate the legs for lunch. Sometimes, they tied two grasshoppers together with a short thread and then watched them try to jump. They would make bets. The first one that fell on its back was the loser. They occasionally played with girls. One co-ed game called Grizzly Bear consisted of a bear inside a circle who tried to capture children outside the circle who were protected by a mother. The children would run into the circle, trying to steal some of the bear's sugar. At night, they listened to their elders tell terrifying stories of Piamumpets, the big cannibal owl, a mythological creature who dwelt in a cave in the Wichita Mountains and came out by night to eat naughty children. Quanah would have gone about naked until he was 9 years old, except when the weather was severely cold. After that, he wore a breech clout, leggings, and moccasins. The leggings often had fringe work, a trademark of the Comanches. In winter, he wore a heavy robe made from a buffalo that had been killed in the late fall, when the creature had grown a dark brown winter fur that was up to 20 inches thick. Plainsmen and soldiers claimed that one such robe offered more warmth than four heavy army-issue woolen blankets. As a boy approached puberty, life quickly became more serious. These were the high, lonesome plains, after all, and his tribe lived a hard and brutal nomadic life where nothing was guaranteed. Skill in hunting was the only real guarantee of survival, and thus he was expected to perfect his skills in archery. The Comanches were known as exceptional archers, both from horseback and on foot. From 50 yards, a warrior could reliably hit an object the size of a doorknob 4 out of 5 times. From 10 to 15 yards, he could shoot a 20 to 30 inch arrow with such force that it would drive entirely through the carcass of a 2,000-pound buffalo if it did not hit bone. A Comanche boy had to learn to make fire. In those years, it was done by hand-twirling a fire drill on a soft stick that was surrounded with a gunpowder-laden rag. In the old days, Spanish moss tinder or bird's nests were used. He had to learn basic wilderness skills, like telling whether an observed animal was heading toward or away from water. One example was a bird called the dirt dauber. If his mouth was empty, the observer knew he was going straight to water. With puberty, too, came the rituals that would transform them, in the eyes of the tribe, from boys to men. One of these was the vision quest, a version of which existed in most North American Indian tribes. For Comanches, it began with a swim in a river or stream, a form of purification. The young man then ventured out to a lonely place where he would see no one, clad only in breech clout and moccasins. With him he carried a buffalo robe, a bone pipe, tobacco, and fire-making materials. On the way to his secluded spot, he stopped 4 times, each time smoking and praying. At night he smoked and prayed for power. He looked for signs in the animals and rocks and trees around him. He fasted. Unlike some of the Northern Plains tribes, there was no self-torture involved. Usually this lasted 4 days and nights, but the idea was for the young brave to remain in place until he received a vision. We do not know exactly what the result of Quanah's vision quest was. Later, he told of dreaming of a bear. His medicine as an adult was bear medicine, which meant that the bear was the source of his power, his puja. Comanche adolescents also sought spirit power in the ritual of the eagle dance, in which the warrior dancers proceeded to a nearby camp to capture a girl, usually an actual captive. After they returned, there was singing and drumming, and the young men danced, imitating the cry of eagles. The idea was that they were young eagles attempting to leave the nest. After the Battle of Pease River, Quanah's life underwent a profound and unpleasant change. The comfort and status of being a chief's son vanished immediately. He was an orphan in a culture that did not easily accommodate orphans. At first, he was cared for by his father's Indian wife. But she died within the year, leaving him and his brother with no near relatives to care for them. "We were often treated very cruelly," he said later, "as orphans only of Indians are treated." Then Peanuts died too, of unknown causes. Quanah was left alone. "It then seemed to me that I was left friendless," he recalled. "I often had to beg for my food and clothes, and could scarcely get anyone to make or mend my clothes. I at last learned that I was more cruelly treated than the other orphans on account of my white blood." In spite of this hardship, Quanah became a full warrior when he was 15 years old. He was a large, long-limbed boy, much taller and stronger than the average Comanche. As an adult, he was a strapping six-footer, nearly a head taller than many of his peers. In later photos, the sheer mass of his biceps and forearms is apparent. If he was treated cruelly for a time, that treatment must surely have stopped as he grew into young manhood. Quanah was no one to tangle with. He was also strikingly handsome, fully dark-skinned Comanche, but with a classical, straight Northern European nose, high cheekbones, and piercing light gray eyes that were as luminous and transparent as his mother's. He somehow looked completely Indian, without looking Asiatic, and could have served as a model for how white people thought a noble savage ought to look, not the least because he looked a bit like them. He was a superb archer and an accomplished hunter. As a youth and as a warrior, he became known for his careless, daredevil sort of courage, quite in contrast with the stealthy, deadly character of Indian warfare. He was also, as he would prove conclusively later in his life, extremely intelligent. He was by nature aggressive, forthright, and fearless, and these qualities were on display at a young age. When he was only 7 years old, Quanah, who had been given a small piece of meat one night at dinner, challenged an adult guest who had gotten a larger piece, explaining that the situation was unfair. The astonished guest gave the young boy the meat, which he could not finish. His mother, Cynthia Ann, later punished him by cramming the rest of the meat down his throat. There was never anything subtle about Quanah, either in war or in peace. The other thing that distinguished him in the years after the Pease River fight was his smoldering hatred of white men. "He wished to avenge the wrong," his son Baldwin Parker wrote later. He understood, too, that white people were responsible for his father's death. His first raid was a foray with 30 warriors from a camp in southwestern Kansas. The raiding party rode south through Oklahoma all the way to San Antonio. The goal appears to have been horses as opposed to revenge. They indulged themselves in what, for the Comanches, was routine mischief. They stole 38 horses and killed and scalped two unfortunate white men who happened to cross their path. As was often the case after raids, they were pursued by white horsemen. They rode hard for 3 days and outdistanced them, returning home triumphantly with their large herd and two scalps. A war dance was held in their honor. Quanah's second raid was more interesting. This time he rode out with 60 warriors from their camp in what is now western Oklahoma. They swept west and south into New Mexico, ending up on the Penasco River in the eastern part of the territory. At one point, they spotted a company of U.S. Army cavalry headed in the other direction. Instead of leaving them alone, which most Comanches would have done without a second thought, the war chief decided it would be a good idea to steal the cavalry's 60 mules. So they did. The cavalry soon followed and caught up with the Indians, who could only move the bulky mules so fast. Quanah was dispatched with two other braves to drive the mules into the mountains, while the rest of the party took up defensive positions in a rocky pass. A 2-hour shooting fight ensued, with no casualties on either side. Night fell, the soldiers retired to their camp, while the Indians, as usual, beat a fast pace toward home. They traveled all night, then all day, then all night, finally stopping and sleeping in a circle around their mules. They were so exhausted that when they awoke, they found that many of their precious mules had wandered half a mile from camp. When they returned with the captured herd, another glorious war dance was held in their honor. In 1868, at age 20, Quanah took part in an extended expedition into Mexico with 9 warriors under the command of the Kiowa chief Tohausen, famous from the Battle of Adobe Walls in 1864, where his combined forces of Comanches and Kiowas had come remarkably close to defeating a U.S. Army force commanded by the legendary Kit Carson. The Mexican raid was a classic Comanche and Kiowa enterprise, one of the ways young, ambitious men traditionally made their names and fortunes. In 1852, Captain Randolph Marcy described the phenomenon that took warriors away for as long as 2 years. 6 or 9 young men set out upon one of these adventures, and the only outfit they require is a horse, with their war equipments consisting of bows and arrows, lance and shield, with occasionally a gun. Thus prepared, they set out on a journey of 1,000 miles or more through a perfectly wild and desolate country, dependent for assistance wholly upon such game as they may chance to find. They make their way to the northern provinces of Mexico. But times had changed. It was now much harder to go blithely adventuring about the American Southwest in search of loot and glory. Comanche power was still strong and still dominant west of the 98th meridian and east of the Rockies and the Grand Cordillera, but it was no longer unchallenged. A line of forts had been thrown up along the San Antonio-El Paso Trail, whose purpose was both to protect wagon trains, but also to disrupt traditional Comanche raiding patterns into Mexico. Fort Stockton, for example, was built near the site of the plentiful icy waters of Comanche Springs, one of the largest springs in Texas, and for 100 years, the main way station for raiders traveling to Mexico. In a bone-dry country, the waterhole was an important landmark. Now it was useless to Quanah and his fellow braves. They would never drink its clear, chill waters again. Tohausen's expedition sounds remarkably inglorious. The days of the great and productive Mexican raiding were fast coming to a close. Comanches would never again be allowed to indulge themselves in the bloody, summer-long raids that emptied out whole districts in northern Mexico and left burning ruins behind over whole states, raids that produced hundreds or thousands of captured horses who then moved in long lines northward through Texas along the Comanche Trace. Quanah's war party was out for months. Twice they went 2 days without water. They nearly starved in Chihuahua. They found Mexican settlements bristling with hostility and only a few horses to steal. Quanah and a friend lost their mules on the long trek back across northern Mexico and Texas. They arrived back at their village on foot. By his own account, the journey was a complete disaster. There were no victory dances to celebrate his return. If he hadn't been so young and carefree and enthusiastic about his life, he might have noticed that time was running out for the Comanches. But this would not be in his thoughts until much later. In 1868, he took part in some of the Comanche raids into the Texas Hill Country, raids that history records as extremely, vengefully violent. One was the infamous raid at the Legion Valley settlement near present-day Llano, where 7 captives were killed, including a baby and a 3-year-old, and where Minnie Caudle was kidnapped. There is no proof that he took part in what the white people regarded as unthinkable atrocities, but this sort of raiding was in fact what young Comanche men were doing in the waning days of the Plains Empire, and Quanah himself was known to burn for revenge against the people who killed his father and stole his mother and sister. Their actions amounted to what we would today consider to be political terror. There was still status in horse thieving, to be sure. But all Comanches knew that the one sure way to roll back the frontier was to torture, rape, and kill all of its white residents. Thus, as time went by, the raids took on a more purely political character, and with good reason. There was plenty of evidence that such a strategy worked. Quanah became a war chief at a very young age. He did it in the traditional way by demonstrating in battle that he was braver, smarter, fiercer, and cooler under fire than his peers. His transformation took place in two different fights. Both happened in the late 1860s, and both have been claimed as the vehicles of his elevation. In one, the raid originated in a camp in the Llano Estacado. The leader was a chief named Bear's Ear. Quanah himself had grown up mostly with the Nokoni band. But councils before this expedition were held by Here's the Sunrise, who was a chief of the Yamparicas, the Yap Eaters, whose domain was traditionally above the Canadian River. Also present was Milky Way, a Penetica chief who had chosen not to go to the reservation with most of the rest of his band, and who was married to a Yamparica. Such commingling suggests a blurring of band loyalty, and indeed, this was happening. From 1868 to 1872, Quanah spent most of his time with the Quahadis, a band that seems to have coalesced out of the Kotsotikas in the 1850s, perhaps out of a desire to remain aloof and pure on the high plains. He also camped a good deal with the Kotsotikas, and his raiding parties were very likely mixed. With the onslaught of whites and the reduction of the hunting ranges, the old geographic separation of bands was disappearing. Bear's Ear's expedition roared east from the high flat plains, across the palisaded rock headlands, and down into the rolling, broken, and river-crossed plains, and eventually collided with the line of settlement, which had continued to roll eastward like a receding wave. It was farther east than it had been when Peter Nakona raided it in 1860. The raiders struck hard at the ranches and farms in the area of Gainesville, 50 miles north of Fort Worth. They probably killed people, though this is not recorded. They managed to steal a large herd of horses and headed home. They got as far as the Red River when they were intercepted by a force of soldiers that had been dispatched from Fort Richardson near Jacksboro to find them. A bloody fight followed, during which Bear's Ear was killed. As we have seen, the death of the chief, and thus the failure of his medicine, usually turned the tide of battle in favor of the white men. Dispirited and leaderless, the Indians often picked up the chief's body and fled. Not this time. In the absence of Bear's Ear, Quanah took over. "Spread out," he yelled to his warriors. "Turn the horses north to the river." This was a departure from Bear's Ear's original plan. With Quanah urging them on, the Comanches wheeled the herd about and raced over rough ground toward the river. As Quanah retreated with the others, he was pursued by a bluecoat, who fired at him. Instead of spurring his horse harder to get away, Quanah rounded on his adversary and confronted the soldier head-on. He then charged, and like a medieval joust, the two warriors thundered toward each other, weapons out. The soldier fired his revolver. His bullet grazed Quanah's thigh. Quanah's arrow, meanwhile, found its mark in the man's shoulder. He dropped his weapon, turned his horse, and fled. But Quanah was now exposed to the fire of other soldiers. He dropped down behind his horse in the old Comanche way, and with bullets singing all around him, raced after his own war party. Somehow, they managed to swim with their stolen stock across the river to safety. The white soldiers did not pursue them. That night around the campfire, the Comanche war party chose Quanah as their leader. The other battle took place in the summer of 1869. Quanah, 63 other Indians, and some Mexicans left camp in Santa Fe. They rode east to cattle ranches located around present-day San Angelo. These would have been the westernmost settlements in the state of Texas in that year, located not coincidentally near the U.S. Army forts Chadbourne, established 1852, and Concho, established 1867. As Quanah later told it, he and some of his friends discovered a cowboy camp just a few miles from Fort Concho and a small herd of horses. The Indians hid in rocks and bushes, waited until nightfall, then stampeded the horses capturing the best ones for themselves. The cowboys fired into the darkness, but hit no one. The Indians continued south, riding by night, into the Texas Hill Country west of San Antonio, where they killed a man who was driving a team of oxen. News of the shooting traveled quickly through the settlement. 30 men rode in pursuit of the raiders. The whites soon caught them, and a battle ensued. According to Quanah, the white men had long-range rifles, probably buffalo guns. The Indians were losing the battle, and they began a retreat. Quanah, however, did not fall back with the rest. He concealed himself in the bushes beside the trail, and when two of the white men rode by, he emerged and killed both of them with his lance, a bravura performance that was witnessed by the other warriors. They quickly reformed and charged, and the Texans were forced into cover. A brief shooting fight followed, with no resolution. The Indians ran out of ammunition and withdrew. That night, in council on the San Saba River, this war party too elected Quanah as their leader. Quanah's conspicuous bravery on the battlefield meant that he became, at a very young age, one of a small select group of Comanche men who would lead the tribe's final raiding and military expeditions in the last years of their freedom. Their world was getting noticeably smaller. The following year, there were less than 4,000 Comanches left in the world. Of those, a mere 1,000 had refused, like Quanah, to go to the reservation. The most dramatic story of Quanah's early life involves his marriage. He had many wives later in life, but none of his unions was ever as dramatic as his marriage to his second wife, whose name was Wekia. His first wife was apparently a Mescalero Apache, about whom little is known. The wedding probably took place in the early 1870s. In any case, the story begins with a familiar premise. Quanah was in love with Wekia. They had grown up together. She was in love with him. She beaded his moccasins and bow quiver. They wanted to marry. There was just one problem. Her father, Old Bear, opposed it. This was partly because of Quanah's white blood, and partly because, as an orphan, and thus a pauper, he had no standing in the tribe. Complicating matters was a rival suitor, one Tanap, son of Ekitoakup, who was a wealthy chief. Wekia did not like Tanap at all. At the heart of Quanah's problem was that most important unit of Comanche wealth, horseflesh. Tanap's father, who owned 100 horses, offered 10 of them for Wekia's hand in marriage. Quanah could only offer one horse. Still, Wekia implored him to try to match Tanap's offer, so Quanah went to his friends and managed to gather up 10 horses. He then drove them to Old Bear's teepee and presented them. Unfortunately, Ekitoakup had already heard of his plan and had doubled his offer. Undeterred, Quanah came up with a new idea. Now he told Wekia that their only hope was to elope. This was not uncommon in Comanche culture. An impoverished suitor often had no choice but to abscond with the bride. When a girl learned that a rich suitor whom she did not care to marry was about to propose, wrote Wallace and Hobel in their classic ethnographic study of the tribe, she might elope with the man she loved. Couples occasionally eloped when the boy was poor and unable to furnish enough ponies or other articles of value to satisfy the parents of the girl. In such a case, the relatives and friends of the boy might supply the necessary ponies to soothe the dishonor suffered by the wife's parents. Quanah had no such family, which meant that by taking Wekia, he risked death, as did Wekia. Comanche families could be quite unforgiving about such things, and it was a simple enough matter for a powerful chief like Ekitoakup to recruit an expedition to seek retribution from a young man who had so grossly violated cultural protocols. But Quanah had something more than simple elopement in mind. Before he and Wekia left, he recruited what amounted to an insurance policy, a war party of 21 young Comanche warriors. Together they rode south for 7 hours, not breaking a trot except when crossing streams. This was as fast as Comanches could travel, and could only have been done with a large number of mounts for each warrior. So fearful were they of what might be pursuing them that they traveled by night for 2 nights, split up and rejoined a number of times, then split again into units of 2, coming together at Double Mountain, near the present town of Snyder in West Texas. They finally stopped on the North Concho River near the town of San Angelo and, as Quanah put it, went to stealin' horses. They stayed there for more than a year, during which time Quanah built the camp into his own power base. Their main activity was horse stealing. "We just stole horses all over Texas," according to Quanah. With time, some of his young and daring cohorts returned to their main camp, telling tales of riches and adventure and Quanah's leadership, returning to the North Concho with their sweethearts or wives, as well as other young men who wanted to ride with Quanah. At the end of the year, Quanah's band numbered several hundred. They owned a large horse herd. Meanwhile, Wikia's elopement had not stopped gnawing at Ekitoakup, and he finally decided he would mount an expedition to get her back. By now, everyone knew where Quanah was. Ekitoakup rode south with a war party and arrived at the renegade camp on the river. It is not clear what he expected to find, but what he and his warriors found themselves confronting was Quanah's entire band, armed and painted and drawn up for battle. Shocked by the number of warriors, Ekitoakup became alarmed for his own safety. Instead of fighting, he decided to settle. 4 leaders from each side met on neutral ground. After much smoking and haggling, a deal was made. Ekitoakup would receive 19 horses, the pick of Quanah's herd. In exchange, Quanah would be granted the right to return to the tribe. Quanah observed, after the deal was concluded, that he knew a ranch where he could steal 19 comparable horses in a few hours. The deal was sealed with a night of feasting and dancing. Because Quanah's band had by this time become too large to be left in peace in that part of Texas, he followed Ekitoakup back home the next day, where he found that he enjoyed new status as a fully fledged war chief. 14. Uncivil Wars. The year Quanah became a warrior, 1863, was the bloodiest year in American history, though most of the blood that was shed had nothing at all to do with this ambitious Comanche boy who rode free on the western plains, stealing horses and taking scalps. The agent of death and destruction was the Civil War. That year, it was transformed forever from the relatively brief, self-contained regional conflict most people believed it would be, into the malevolent, drawn-out, continent-girding affair that threatened to rip the country permanently apart. 1863 was the year of Chancellorsville and Chickamauga, of Vicksburg and Chattanooga, the year Robert E. Lee marched 75,000 rebel troops clear into Pennsylvania, into the great heartland of the North, where they fought the Union to a grisly 51,000 casualty draw at Gettysburg. The Civil War had very little to do with the Western frontier itself. All of its main engagements took place east of the Mississippi River, and such action as there was in Texas, Kansas, New Mexico, and the Indian Territory did not involve the free horse tribes. Still, the war managed to tear that frontier apart. It did so not with armies of men and rolling caissons, but with simple neglect. Preoccupied with the war, and in any case lacking the money to fight Indians, federal and Confederate governments alike had no choice but to leave the West to its own devices. That meant that, quite suddenly, most of the people who had defended the borderlands in the 1840s and 1850s, from the Rangers to the 2nd Cavalry to various state militias, were simply gone. The men who won victories with Ford at Antelope Hills, or Van Dorn at Wichita Village, or Ross at Pease River, all departed for eastern battlefields. And with them went the knowledge and will to pursue Comanches into their homelands. In their place rose the state and territorial militias, a sorry lot of inferior soldiers commanded by substandard officers who were ducking the larger war. They were under-equipped as well. They provided their own, often atrocious, weapons. Their lead was in short supply, and some of their powder was so poor that it would not kill a man 10 steps from the muzzle. They suffered from bad food, alcoholism, epidemics of measles and intestinal ills, and in any event were neither brave enough nor smart enough to win fights with Comanches or Cheyennes or Kiowas. One regiment, embarking on an Indian pursuit, decided instead to head to another fort and play poker. They were preoccupied with other concerns anyway, which included their own miniaturized version of the war. In 1861, the Texas militia moved into Indian territory, occupied federal forts, and drove the Union troops north into the brand new state of Texas. There would be periodic small-scale fighting over the territory for the duration of the war, culminating in the Battle of Honey Springs in 1863, in which 3,000 Union troops from Kansas defeated 6,000 Texans and Indians. But these events took place well east of the frontier, which remained ignored and undefended. And this sudden neglect changed everything. Though the bizarrely passive federal policies of the 1850s had opened the way for hundreds of Indian attacks, the decade had in fact closed with a flash of willpower and resolve. Rip Ford's 1858 expedition was a watershed event with few precedents, including what the only Spanish governor to rein in Comanche terror, the brilliant Don Juan Bautista de Anza, had done in his pursuit of Cuerno Verde onto the plains of eastern Colorado in 1779. And while Sol Ross's victory at Pease River in 1860 may not have been quite as glorious as most histories suggest, as a measure of the Taibo's will to defend themselves, it too was a conspicuous advance. Indeed, it would have seemed in the late 1850s, as it had seemed in the late 1830s and the late 1840s, that Comanche power was fast on the wane, that their ability to raid unchallenged would soon come to an end, that their days off the reservation were sharply numbered. And yet all that was an illusion. Comanche history must be understood that way, in terms of pulses and counterpulses of power. The pulse of state and federal power in the late 1850s was awesome. Comanches were running for shelter in the fastness of the Llano Estacado. They would soon have been broken. There were not enough of them left for it to be otherwise. Then the Civil War came, the Texans went off to fight it, and they left their bones in shallow graves all over the South, and the lesson was forgotten again. What is remarkable, in retrospect, is how long it took the Comanches to figure out that border defenses had lapsed, how long it took them to grasp this massive shift in the balance of power. This was partly because both the Union and Confederacy, equally enfeebled in their western zones, were quick to pursue generous new treaties with them. The resulting agreements were versions of the same tired, disingenuous, and ultimately useless promises, but they did delay the inevitable reckoning. The Confederates promised the people gifts and supplies. In exchange, the Indians cheerfully agreed to settle on their reservation, learn how to farm, and stop attacking both white and red people, promises they had no intention of keeping. The treaty was signed by the Comanches who lived on the reservation, mainly Penaticas, as well as the chiefs of the wild Comanche bands, including the Nokoni, Yamparica, Kotsotika, and a remnant of the Tanawish. The Quahadis, magnificently aloof as always, refused to sign anything. The federal government made its own treaty too, one that simply restated the Treaty of 1853, promising the same old annuities and provisions, asking for the same sort of absurd concessions. The first of the horrors to be unleashed by the demon of neglect had little to do with the white man. These were the Indian-on-Indian wars in the Indian Territory, the land north of the Red River and south of Kansas that would eventually become the state of Oklahoma. Most of the conquered and displaced tribes from the East, South, and Midwest had been relocated there, a process that had begun in the early 19th century. In 1830, Congress passed the Indian Removal Act, which forced most tribes to give up all of their lands in the East and Midwest for a supposedly eternal plot of ground in the Indian Territory. By the 1860s, the territory had become an intricate patchwork of Aboriginal cultures, each with its own designated reserve. The larger reserves had been given to the five civilized tribes, Creek, Choctaw, Cherokee, Chickasaw, and Seminole, as well as to the combined Comanche, Kiowa, and Apache tribes, the Cheyennes and Arapahoes, and to the Wichitas and their affiliated tribes, Caddos, Anadarkos, Tonkawas, Tawakonees, Kichais, and Delawares. There were smaller areas for Kickapoos, Sac and Fox, Osages, Pawnees, Potawatomies and Shawnees, Iowas, Peorias, Quapaws, Modocs, Ottawas, Wyandots, Senecas, Poncas, and Otos and Missouris. It was, all in all, an astonishing collision of native interests and antagonisms, all jammed together by fiat of Congress on the rolling plains and timberlands north of the Red River. For many of these tribes, the Civil War was as much of a disaster as it became, eventually, for white farmers in eastern Georgia. The trouble began in 1861, soon after the first shots of the war were fired, when the United States withdrew its troops from Indian Territory. Though there were a few ragtag Confederates scattered through the territory, the agrarian tribes were mostly unprotected from the wild horse tribes, who had always hated them for encroaching on their hunting grounds and for what they saw as their fawning accommodation of the white man. With no one to offer the farming tribes even nominal protection, the Comanches unleashed a terrible violence. These were mostly the wild bands, but the Panaticas from the reservation sometimes rode with them. The Chickasaws were the principal target, though other tribes also fell victim. Comanches raided their farms and settlements just as they raided on the Texas frontier. They rode down upon their foot-bound, house-dwelling, field-tilling victims. Many Chickasaws were driven out of the Indian Territory altogether and into Kansas. Choctaws and Creeks came under Comanche attack too, as did the Indians of the Wichita Reservation, some of whom had copied the settled agrarian ways of the civilized tribes with great success. Comanches made short work of their farms, stock, and crops. Whole settlements were butchered, captives taken. It should be noted that the civilized Indians were not always easy prey. They were often capable fighters, and sometimes they got the better of their tormentors. But Comanche raids were just part of the tragedy. There were also partisan wars between the entrenched tribes. There were Confederate Indians and Union Indians. Many members of the five civilized tribes were slaveholders, which both angered Union Indians and caused deep rifts within their own ranks. The result was a series of massacres and retaliations, most of which are lost to history. What is known about them suggests that they were brutal and widespread. Cherokee, Creek, and Seminole territories became the scenes of battles between loyalists on both sides. Houses and farms were burned, seed stock and farming tools destroyed or stolen. Large segments of those tribes ended the war hungry and destitute, dependent once again upon the government for their livelihood. In 1862, 100 Tonkawas were killed in a single attack. Part of a wave of such incidents that nearly resulted in their extermination. This was ostensibly because of their cannibalism, which the other tribes deplored, but it was more likely because they had long served the Texans as scouts in their anti-Indian expeditions. The Civil War offered many such opportunities for settling scores. As in the larger war, there were massive displacements of human beings. In late 1861, a large body of loyal Creeks and other tribes, under the command of Creek Chief Apothle Yohola, were attacked repeatedly in the last week of December by a combination of Confederate tribes and Texas cavalry. The terrified Union Indians dropped everything and fled northward. Large numbers of them froze in the bitter cold, and many of their bodies were eaten by wolves. Babies were born naked on the snow and soon died of exposure. According to one report, 700 Creeks and others were either killed in the attacks or froze to death. Once in Kansas, they gathered in a refugee camp where things were scarcely better. Families slept on the frozen ground with only scraps of cloth, handkerchiefs, aprons, and such, stretched on saplings as protection against the plains blizzards. The initial composition of that camp reveals much about what the Civil War did to the Indian Territory. It contained 3,168 Creeks, 53 Creek slaves, 38 free Creek Negroes, 777 Seminoles, 136 Quapaws, 50 Cherokees, 31 Chickasaws, and a few Kickapoos. By April, the camp held 7,600 refugees that included Quechuas, Hainais, Biloxis, and Caddos, all of them utterly dispossessed of everything they once owned.
This is the end of the CD. The audiobook continues on the next CD.